streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back. I gotta do right before they
call me home. Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is December 28th, 2011. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a fantastic show for you tonight. We have Mrs. Lori Ann Smith. And she is a child abuse prevention awareness, or I guess she, how do I want to say it? She brings awareness of child abuse and different domestic violence situations to people. She does have her own Blog Talk Radio show, and she's an author of several books. So we're going to bring her on here in just a few minutes. Before I do that, let me welcome Boyd to the show.
Yeah, I just want to say I thank everybody who tunes into the show every week, and we're just glad to have Ms. Smith on the show tonight. So without further ado, we would like to pass the mic over to her to formally introduce herself, and let's kick the show off.
Hi, Lucinda. Hello, Boyd.
Welcome.
That's great. Thanks very much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
No problem. Go ahead and introduce yourself and let the audience know a little bit more about what you do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my name is Lori Ann Smith, and I live in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I'm a child abuse prevention public speaker mainly, talking about all issues surrounding child abuse and also adult survivor issues. I'm trying to reach out to adult survivors as well. And really just promoting awareness, you know, about all the different aspects of child abuse and prevention and whatnot. And I do my own blog talk show here on Blog Talk Radio called The Whole Issue. And I've done about 900 shows in about 2 years. So I've kind of cut back on shows just because I've become really busy and really tired. But I was doing quite a few shows during a week, about 10 shows a week for a while. And I did about 900 shows so far. And I have a lot of people who tune in, and it's great. You know, the support's great, and I appreciate it, people taking the time to tune in. And it's great just to have some place where people can come together, you know, like-minded, and try to do something to change this mess for these children out here. And really, you know, I talk about a lot about, you know, the issues that I had suffered through as a child and my family, domestic violence, and you know, just the aftermath and the child abuse and whatnot. And I have quite a large listener base. You know, it's very great. I'm very humbled by it. And now I do about 5 shows a week. And you can find me on Blog Talk Radio just by typing into your browser, Lori, L-A-U-R-I-E hyphen Smith. And that'll get you to my Blog Talk shows, Lori Smith on Blog Talk Radio. And so I do that as well as volunteer with some groups. I volunteer with about 4 different organizations, mainly dealing with human rights issues and also sex abuse survivors, like CSA survivors and whatnot like that. So I do some volunteering as well. And so I just wish there was more time in the day. I wish I was like 2 people sometimes. You know, there's so many things you want to do, and you want to help out, and you want to make a difference. And there's only so many hours in the day, and there's only so much time, you know, that we can do these things. But as long as we're doing something, I guess that's really what counts. And so, yeah, I started doing this Blog Talk Radio about 2 years ago. It was really a big part of my healing journey as far as my own issues went with the abuse that, you know, dealing with the aftermath of the abuse that I suffered, which really affected my life in a big way. You know, it's a lot of, and it usually does. You know, I was really at my wit's end. You know, I was sort of living like a double life. You know, I'd go to work in the daytime feeling pretty good, and then I'd come home at night sitting on the couch, just me and myself, and wanting to kill myself, wanting to commit suicide, just wanting to end the pain. And I did that for so many years until about the age of 41. And about 5 years ago, I decided that I actually had a night that I made a final decision that I was going to actually reach out and get some help and not suffer on in that silence and not suffer on in that, you know, in that, you know, feeling so alone and just so down by the whole thing. But I decided to start my healing journey. So that was about 5 years ago. So I've made some huge progress in the last 5 years. And so it's great to be on this end of it, but I know what it's like for people who are on the other side of it, you know, and how hard it is on their families, how hard it is on them, you know, and, you know, just the situations that arise, you know, from these things. So, yeah, it's hard. It's a hard world for some people. Some people, you know, it's not an easy road for a lot of people, and it's good to be on this side of it for sure, but I will never forget what it's like to be on the other side of that. Yeah.
Right. You know, tonight as we reach out and try to talk to those, maybe, you know, we can touch somebody who has been in some kind of a domestic violent relationship, whether it's sexual, emotional, psychological, or verbal, any of those. You know, we're grateful that you're able to come on tonight and share your story and let the audience know how you were able to maybe change and heal and get through those hard times, and like you said, you know, even to get past that point where you're wanting to commit suicide because of all the bad memories and thoughts that you've had. Let's go back to when you were young, and you were the youngest of seven children, and, mm-hmm. and you lived in a house full of abuse and dysfunction. Why don't you go ahead and start back there and tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, it was pretty, you know, pretty bad, pretty serious stuff. My parents were, I was born the last of seven children. My parents were already, you know, fighting and already having marital problems long before I was born. And so when I was born, it was not a good thing. It wasn't a happy thing. My mother, it was marital rape is what it was. And so my mother didn't really want me. She didn't want really any of her children with my dad. And they stayed married, you know, they were both born in the mid-20s, 1923, 1927. And they came from a rural farming community in Nova Scotia. And so, you know, their whole belief systems were that, you know, you just stayed together, you know. My mother actually tried to divorce my dad in the 1940s. And up here in Canada, they weren't granting divorces unless it was something like infidelity. So the courts knew even in the 1940s, like the courts knew that my dad was mistreating my mother and mistreating the kids, that my older siblings, and the courts would do nothing about it. So my mother was stuck with my dad basically, unless she just wanted to run away and leave him, sort of thing, right? And here she was, she had like five kids or four kids. So they just stayed together and moved down to the States. So my parents were from Canada, and they moved down to the States, and I was born in New Mexico. And so they were very isolated. They didn't know anybody down there. They didn't have any friends. You know, it was just the two of them, and they weren't coping well. And their coping mechanisms really were zero. So there was a lot of domestic violence, a lot of abuse, and just a lot of blaming and you know, just negativity, very negative, you know, situation. Like there's no love in that house. You know what I mean? And so as my siblings were growing up, you know, it just escalated and just got worse. So by the time I came around, it was pretty bad. And my parents were actually brought up on child abuse charges. Both of them were brought up on child abuse charges. So they had to go to court. And of course, all the kids had to go to court. But I was a baby. I was just a toddler. So I don't remember too much about that. I do remember the social workers coming around afterwards, but I don't remember like the court situation or anything like that. But my siblings do, and the ones that are alive, you know, we've talked about it and stuff. But the courts left us in the home based on the fact that my parents were supposed to meet these requirements, and they were only going to allow us to stay in the home if my parents would actually do what they were supposed to be doing, which was to go and seek counseling. They were both told their own counseling for their own issues because they were both abused. Both my parents were abused as children. And they were both supposed to seek marital counseling as well as psychological counseling and issues for anger management. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Like they were out of control, and they were, you know, back in the 60s, you know, it was pretty common for the system to let the children stay in the home. You know what I mean?
They didn't have any programs back then.
And it was kind of like back in those days, it was like, no, you know, it's a family issue. You know, you have to deal with it within the family sort of thing. Even then, it was still like that.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah, I think, I mean, even, it didn't really change until the 90s. So that just tells you, you know, how long it's taken for the situation to change. And it still is a mess. Like, the system obviously doesn't work, but, you know, thank God for the people that are trying to make it work. But, so I don't blame the system at all. I put the blame where it goes, and that's on my parents. You know, they made the wrong choices, and they did the wrong things. You know, they had the choice. Abuse is a choice. And they had the choice to not abuse each other, and they had a choice to not abuse us. But they didn't make that choice. And they just created this hell for us, you know. So my siblings, it definitely affected my older siblings, and three of my brothers, my older brothers, were into drugs and into petty crimes and stuff, and they ended up doing time. One of my brothers ended up doing time in a federal prison for a little while. I think he did a year in a federal prison for a nonviolent crime. But, you know, it did affect them, absolutely. There was no encouragement in the home, you know, to try to do good in school or to do good, or, you know, just to do anything. It was really just all trying to exist and trying to live in this mess, you know. Some of my siblings didn't follow that road. A couple of my siblings, actually the oldest siblings, the two oldest, did quite well for themselves. They moved away. They left the house really early, like in their teens, and they moved on and did quite well for themselves. But the rest of us just sort of, you know, sort of faltered there, you know. Lack of support, just a lack of parental support, and a lack of care, and just an abusive environment, you know. And my brothers were involved in all kinds of drug use and drug abuse, which I followed suit with in my early, like before I was even a teenager, started doing drugs, and just as a way of escape, you know. So my brothers were, like, their whole lives, they lived on the streets. They were homeless for quite a while when they were on their own and adults, like young adult men, doing time in prisons, various periods of time, you know, for different things, bank robberies and stuff. And, just horrible to see what happens to people, you know, because they're, for some, you know, they don't reach out, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of sad because my two brothers, two of my brothers are dead. They killed themselves, suicide. And I think about that, I think, you know, they had the opportunity to reach out, you know. I mean, everybody does. Sadly enough, people just won't make that choice, you know, for whatever reason. And, I mean, I know because I was sitting there in the same boat wanting to kill myself and realizing that, wow, I was going to head, I'd always been heading that same way. My brothers had gone. And I thought, you know, I don't want to do this. No, I don't want to do this. I want to live, and I want to have a good life, and I want to try to help the people, you know what I mean? Like, this is not the way to go. So, you know, I'm thankful that I could see that, and I wish that everybody could see that.
Your brothers that committed suicide, was one of those brothers the one that molested you when you were young?
Yeah. He was 13 years older than me. So he was, when I was 8, he was 21, and he sexually abused me. Yeah. And he was already having a lot of problems. Like, he was pretty well psychotic. I mean, he had a lot of mental problems. He was doing a lot of drugs. He wasn't coping well at all. He was really the one who took the brunt of my dad's abuse. And so he's the one that the authorities were actually called in because my dad had abused him and was abusing him. And my dad just had a hatred for him for some reason. I don't know. You know, I don't really know what the issue was, why he would have just picked on specifically him. Because my dad was abusive to all of his sons and all of us, but he really had a sort of a hate on for that one brother. And so it's quite sad. That he really did not do well in life at all. And, it affected his life completely. You know, absolutely. So he in turn affected my life, you know, by doing what he did to me, which was to sexually abuse me. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And
hard situation.
Sexually abused you and raped you for about a year.
Yeah. It was. I was close to a year that I can remember because I know the time frame because of where we were living at the time and then who was around, you know what I mean? I didn't really block too much of this stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I have pretty good cognitive memories of just about everything, and I think I did that on purpose just to stay sane. Around 12, 13, I started doing drugs just as a way of escape, you know, but I had all of my memories intact, you know. It's kind of, you just wonder why, you know what I mean? Like, why somebody does these things to children. And I've been asking myself this question for forever. I don't understand why people do these things, you know what I mean? But he chose to do that, and he moved away to Canada later that year. And I didn't see him again for a couple years, which I was glad. I was very happy about. But I loved my brother, you see. But you know, before he actually sexually abused me. And then after, I couldn't figure out why he would hurt me, why he would do that. And so then I was afraid of him after that, right? So he did come and visit from Canada a couple of times. I saw him a couple of times after, where he came to see my mom, mainly because he didn't care about my dad. But he came just to visit my mom, and he was having a real hard time and doing a whole lot of drugs and had tried to kill himself many times, quite a few times, actually, that we know about. And so he was visiting a few times, and I was very nervous with him in the house. I was still a young teen, actually a preteen. And then I didn't see him I was about 12. That's about the last time I saw him, 12, turning 13. And then he was just visiting, just staying for a few weeks or a few months. I forget how long he stayed, but he was in the house. But he went back to Canada and then tried to kill himself at the age I was 13 or just turning 13. So he would have been 26. And he phoned and he was talking to me on the phone. And I had kind of blocked out a lot of this sexual assaults and the stuff to do with the sexual abuse, you know, because I was just trying to survive in that home with the abuse from my parents, you know. And so that just was something else that just got tucked away, you know, for a later date. And he was talking to me on the phone while he was committing suicide, and he actually admitted to me that, you know, he was talking to me like sexually, like he was when he had actually sexually abused me. And it brought back all of these memories, and I thought, oh my God, you know what I mean? Like, here he is killing himself, and all he can think of is this sexual stuff with me. I couldn't believe it. You know, it just blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, he's so messed up. And so I didn't talk to him after that. And I didn't talk to him at all after that. And then when he was 33, he killed himself, yeah. So I had just turned 20, just going on 21, yeah. So yeah, pretty harsh situation, absolutely. You know, this is a sad situation. I mean, we know that these things happen. You know, as far as this, you know, child sexual abuse goes, the stats are what they are. You know, like 5 to 10% is stranger danger. People are always warning their children, oh, stay away from the strangers. You know, watch out for strangers. I mean, you know, you really have to warn your family about your family. You know, it's like, okay.
Most abuse is from someone that you know, and most likely a relative.
Yeah, that's right. And so this is the thing. It's a huge issue. And so I really like to promote, you know, those the groups that are doing work like, you know, My Body Belongs to Me, the books that are out there. Little Warriors does a whole lot of work to promote education regarding child sexual abuse and whatnot. And that's up here in Canada. And then there's so many great groups, you know, out there that are doing this work. So if you're a parent, you're listening to the show, you know, make sure you educate yourself about the issues surrounding child sexual abuse. Protect your children. Learn how to protect them, you know what I mean? And learn how to help them protect themselves, right? But yeah, it was a sad situation for sure, absolutely was. I felt sorry for my brothers, you know, because I knew what they had gone through. I was a witness. I was there in the house. You know, I knew what they had gone through. And yet, you know, we all have to make our choices, you know what I mean? And so it was a hard situation because I loved my family, and watched this family be disintegrated in front of me was horrible, you know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's tragic. It never should have happened. And, you know, I sit there and it's not something you can go back or you can just forget about. It's not something you can just put behind you. You know, people say, oh, well, just got to forget about it and move on. I mean, this is my family. You know what I mean? And there was so many, you know, involved. And now we're down to just a few. And one of my brothers was murdered. It was a cold case that the FBI just closed because they couldn't figure out, like, they had to close it. They didn't know who did it. And then two of my brothers killed themselves. So it was pretty tragic, you know, sort of seemed like a crisis all the time, something going on. Yeah, hard on people.
And how are the other siblings that are still alive? Or did they go through the same thing, obviously?
Well, they're sort of, they're doing all right. Yeah, they're older than me by a few years. One of my older brothers is he's one of the oldest brothers. He is the oldest brother. He's doing quite well. He just sort of, he moved away. Like, he actually kind of ran away, but he didn't have to run away because, you know, I mean, my parents wouldn't have to go look for him. He was 16 years old, and he just left, and he moved out on his own and took off. And he said he wished that he could have taken us with him, but, you know, at the age of 16, there's no way. You know, you can't take on seven kids, like six kids at the age of 60. So he took off, and he went and had, he got his life going pretty good, and he ended up having a pretty good life. You know, he's got a good wife, and they've got a son, and he's actually got a pretty good situation going on there. You know, so that, I'm happy for him. My sister did quite well for herself. She's the one next and oldest to me, the next oldest to me, and she's. Really, I mean, it affected her too, for sure. You know, but she's doing quite well. You know, she's handled things quite well. She didn't do drugs. She never turned to drugs or anything like that. She just sort of, I don't know, dealt with it, I guess, in her own way. You know what I mean?
Was she sexually abused as well, or just physically?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I actually did talk to her about. Let's see. It was at least a year ago, I believe it's December of 2010. I actually talked to her about it and told her, you know, that I was sexually abused by her brother Rob. And I just threw it out there because I thought, well, if she was molested or if she was sexually abused, then maybe if I tell her, then she'll feel comfortable to tell me, you know, if she was. But she never said anything. She didn't say, oh, I don't believe you, or, oh, you know, you're just making that up, or, oh, you know, nothing. I just got a cold kind of a nothing, you know what I mean? So it's hard on our family. Like, nobody wants to, like, our family's very dysfunctional. Like, we still don't get along at all. So, like, there's no closeness. There's no feeling, like, you know, there's no closeness there. So, yeah,
Are your parents still alive?
One of my parents is still alive. Yeah, my dad is still alive, and he's about 90 years old. He lives in a senior's lodge. And, you know, he's got his regrets. You know, he does, you know, we've talked to him, I mean, we've talked to him our whole lives about this whole mess, you know what I mean, just kind of griping at him and trying to make him own up to it, but he never really wanted to own up to it. But, you know, it has obviously affected his life. You know, he's not necessarily happy with the way it turned out. You know, he's lost three sons and one daughter to cancer, and, you know, we've had some pretty sad situations in our family. One of my nephews was killed by a drunk driver, and so our family's kind of dwindled, and then my mom passed away quite a few years ago. But yeah, it's hard. He's mentally ill somewhat. He was diagnosed schizophrenic and borderline personality disorder years ago, back when they were brought up on charge. So he doesn't he doesn't have, like, any real empathy. Like, he doesn't feel that he hurt his family or that he hurt his wife, or, you know, he doesn't understand what he did and how it affected us, right?
Right. And so, I don't know if you've talked about it with him or not, but were your grandparents abusive to your parents at all? Do you know anything about that?
I know on my mom's side there was abuse on my mom's side, and it was from my mom's mother. My mom's mother was just notoriously bad. And she was just a hard woman, and they were growing up in the, you know, in the pre-Depression era, the Depression era, and in a poor, like, rural farming community. That she had quite a few children. She had seven children. So my mom was the oldest of seven, and she was just an abusive tyrant of a woman who beat on her husband and all of her children, and then took in a whole bunch of orphans from down the road because an orphanage was overcrowded. So this my grandmother took in a whole bunch of orphans. And then abused them too, and then they all ran away. yeah, my mom said, "Well,
if you took the orphans in, she'd have a big heart and want to help them."
It's pretty sad. She took them in just so they could work the farm. She just wanted farm help.
Exactly.
So it's kind of sad. Wow. And to the Barb, yeah. And so, yeah, and she was a terrible woman. Like, she beat one of her sons to death and wasn't brought up on any charges or anything like that. And my mother, so was my uncle. And so my mom grew up under this and then, you know, inevitably turned it, even though she didn't want to be a bad mother. She didn't want to look like a bad mother. That was her big thing her whole life, you know. But she was doing the same things that her mother was doing. You know, she was just as violent and just as vicious and just as, you know, abusive as her mother. So, you know, the cycle just passed on. Yeah, absolutely. My dad's side, there's some bizarre talk about, you know, a lot of neglect. And I don't know about any, like, physical abuse. There may have been some. I think it was mainly just neglect and maybe some psychological abuse there, spiritual abuse and whatnot. I think the children were made to feel that they're, you know, that they really weren't wanted and that they were a burden and, you know, this type of stuff. So my dad was always needing to feel, I don't know, and he, you know, he needed to be number one. So when with all of these children in the home, with the, when all these kids came around, my mother obviously didn't have time just for him. It was about the kids, right? And so he became jealous. I seriously think that's what it was, is that he became jealous of the attention she was spending on the kids, and so he took it out on her. Yeah. And, yeah, she was very physically ill from having all of these children and also just having a lot of health problems herself. Like, she had all kinds of health problems, but she was abused physically from my grandmother, right? So she wasn't doing all that great. And then he was physically abusing her. So she was just a mess. And then he would, you know, he just wanted his needs met. You know, it's just all about him, not about her. You know, he wouldn't buy her anything. He withheld money, he withheld just everything. You know, he wouldn't buy her any clothes. She wasn't working, so she had to make her own clothes. You know, it was just one of those situations. She was pretty well a prisoner, really. She felt like she was a prisoner, and she really felt that she didn't have any options. But she did have options. And when the courts got involved, when my parents were both busted on child abuse charges, the courts were like, you know, you don't have to stay in this. You know what I mean? Like, you could, you know, let your children, you could try to raise your children if you want to on your, you know, with the help of the state, or you could, you know, separate for a while, you know, this type of thing. But she just felt like she didn't have any options. But she did have options. And it's kind of sad that she didn't see that, that she didn't feel that she had those options, yeah, that she could do it. Yeah. Right. Unfortunately.
And I think that's the way some women feel, too, when they're in these relationships, as far as domestic violence and stuff. They're broken down so much that their self-esteem is so low that they feel that they can't do anything on their own out there, that they need this other person to, you know, whether it's financially or you know,
yeah, it is. Because it's like, well, how are we gonna live? You know, how are we gonna manage, right, without income, you know, and just living on the state welfare check, you know, it's hard on people. Absolutely it is.
It's hard, definitely. You know, and we know too that years ago, like we said, you know, this is just the way it was. You got, you know, whether it was beat or spankings or, you know, whatever, the government didn't interfere in your family life. Your family, you know, that's just the way it was. Whether, you know, we know a lot of people were sexually abused, emotionally mm-hmm. abused, physically abused, verbally abused, financially abused, what have you. But, you know, and as time has gone on, we've learned that you know, we do have the choices to change things and to get out of those situations and that we can break that chain of pain. Mm-hmm. Tell us from your perspective, I mean, you went through a lot to almost committing suicide, and that was maybe the final straw that broke you down to break that chain of pain. Can you talk a little bit about what you went through at that moment?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I was saying, I was kind of living like a double life, you know, like I was going to work, having fun. I could laugh and have a good time with my friends, no problem, you know, and work, hold down a job, which is great, you know, that's wonderful. So I'm high functioning, very high functioning. But then, I get home at the end of the day and I was just stuck with me and my memories of all of this stuff from the past and just feeling so, spiritually low and just down and feeling very unloved and unwanted because I was, you know. I never really felt any connections really to you know, to too many people. I don't make, you know, never have been able to make very many lasting friendships. I just was feeling very lonely and down, and I thought, you know, how long am I going to be in this pain, you know? Like, I want people to see how much pain I'm in. I need the world to see it. So I was really considering self-injuring at that point. And then I thought, well, I should just end it, you know? So all these little thoughts were going through my mind as I was sitting on the couch after work one night. It was just kind of a normal thing for me. This is what I would do periodically throughout the year. Think, you know, something would just bring me down, and it would just sort of spiral and escalate further down into this sort of depression, right? And I thought, you know, how long can I deal with this? How long am I going to take this? You know, it's just too hard on my heart. It's too hard on my body and too hard on my mind, you know? And I was sitting there, and I thought, well, you know, like, if I self-injure, like, who's going to care? Like, nobody, you know? And who's even going to know, like, who's even going to understand why I would be self-injuring if I end up, you know, trashing myself or ripping myself to shreds like I wanted to do? And I thought, that's not going to make any sense. And I've been hurt enough as it is. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And I thought, well, then how am I going to show the world my pain? Because I need somebody, like, in other words, I need help. It was really the first time that I actually admitted that I needed help to myself. You know what I mean? And it was a realization that came in, and I thought, wow, I really do need help. And so I thought, well, other people get help, you know? Like, other people see other survivors out here getting help. Like, why am I not reaching out, you know? And I started to ask myself these questions, and I thought, if I kill myself, like, who's going to care? Nobody in my family is going to care because they're all going to expect me to kill myself. Because my family, the remaining members, lump me in with my brothers, see? I'm just like my brothers. I've always been labeled as one of them, a drug user and a loser, you know, this person who is just going to be a loser the rest of their life sort of thing, right? And so, you know, I thought, yeah, they're not going to care. You know, they might shed a few tears, and they're going to figure that's exactly what I would do. So it's not, you know, who would I be doing this for? You know what I mean? I thought, why would I be doing that? So I said, okay, this is ridiculous. You know, I've got to reach out. I have to get help. And no matter what it is, you know, whether it's self-help or you know, going to a counselor, therapist, or whatever, but I'm going to get help because I didn't deserve what happened to me in the first place. That was not my fault. Now, the adult, you know, decisions that I'm making today are definitely my fault. you know what I mean? The decisions that I'm making today are my responsibility. But what happened to me as a child was not my fault, you know? And so I don't have to carry the shame of that. That's not my shame. That doesn't belong to me. You know what I mean? And I started to realize this. And as I started to think about it, I thought, you know what? I will never, ever again decide, you know, to think about suicide ever again. Not ever. Like, I made a commitment to myself that night. I said, that is it. I'm going to heal. A fight started with, like a fire kind of came alive within me, and I thought, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to heal. That was the first time I actually realized that I could do this, that I was self-empowered, that I could do this, you know. So, yeah, it just sort of came on me one night. It was about March of 2007, and yeah, it's been great. Like, I'm not looking back, that's for sure. May of 2007, I had this most amazing spiritual experience. Well, I'm a Christian, and I grew up not liking Christians because my dad was a Christian, and my dad was born again Christian. He'd come home from church and he would abuse us every Sunday. So I just did not like Sundays. I did not like church. I did not like God. I was very angry with God. And had all kinds of problems with God. But I loved Jesus, you know. And because I grew up in a Western culture and Christian background, right? So, makes sense to me. And in May 2007, I met the Lord Jesus. And he was here to meet me, you know, when I needed him. Which was right after, you know, within about a month and a half after I had decided that I would live and not die, you know. I started to open up my heart, you know, and I believe that that's sort of what happened. I started to open up my heart, and I realized that I needed him, you know. I needed a savior. I needed love to come in my heart. I needed life. I needed light and truth and goodness and mercy and compassion and everything that is good to come into my heart because I was really, you know, hurting. And I thought, man, this is, May 22nd, 2007 is when this happened. It was the middle of the day. I was by myself in my apartment, and I was without a job, and I didn't know where my next rent was coming from or my next groceries or anything else. And but I wasn't too concerned about that. You know, I'm kind of used to having to just kind of get by. And so I was just getting ready to look for more jobs, and here I turned the corner in my apartment to go down the hall, and here in front of me was this spiritual apparition, really a spiritual form of, and I knew who it was, and it was Jesus. And he said, "Pass up your burdens to me. That is what I'm here for." And I was like, "Oh, praise God." So I got really excited. And this is from somebody who would not read the Bible, who did not like Christians, and would not, you know what I mean? Like, I was totally, you know, I wasn't like anti-Christian, but I did not want to have anything to do with it. And so this is coming from somebody who would have not picked up a Bible previously 5 years ago, right? So, yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing, absolutely. And, yeah, I'm pretty happy. Things are going pretty good.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I think a lot of times until we can find that higher power or know that God loves us unconditionally, it's hard for us to accept ourselves with all of the abuse and things that have happened to us growing up. You know, we're just not feeling that love or that acceptance, I think. And until we meet Jesus or we find out, you know, that there is true unconditional love and that somebody loves us no matter what we've gone through, you know, whether it's our fault or somebody else's fault, then we can truly be able to forgive ourselves and forgive others and move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's the thing. And I mean, that's because I was in hell. My first book that I wrote, A Life of Death, The Redemption, really was basically a, you know, really describing the hell that I grew up in. And I really called it hell on earth because that's what it was. And, you know, it was our own private little hell. And, you know, I remember being a child. I remember being 10 years old and thinking, you know, actually telling my mother to go ahead and kill me because I was dead, you know. Like, I was spiritually dead. I was like, just go ahead and kill me. I don't care, you know. Like, one more blow.
You can only take so much beating, and then you're just ready to give up and say, okay, you know, yeah, I'm tired.
And 2 years prior to, I had been raped and sodomized, sexually used by my brother. My mother knew about it, did nothing to stop it. You know, I was physically sick from it, not only that, but emotionally sick from it, you know, psychologically sick from it. And then at the age of 10 years old, my mother was still beating on me, still trashing me. She was still doing that until I was like 17 years old. I mean, you know, I was just like, go ahead, just kill me. Get me out of my misery. Please do, you know. And by the time I was 12, I started doing real heavy drugs, you know, and I would do massive amounts of drugs. And I really didn't care if I died or not. It didn't matter to me if I woke up the next day. I was like, whatever, it doesn't matter to me anyway. You know what I mean? So that was my attitude. I sort of straightened it around when I hit 21. I decided I really didn't want to live this violent life on the streets, you know. Like, I started hanging around with a whole lot. These were my good friends. Like, I love these people. And I always will. These were my good friends, and I would never think anything else of them. We were all hurting, and we were all coming from the same kind of homes, and we all sort of hung out in it was a bit of a, not a gang, not a real gang like today, but we had our own little, you know, group. Yeah, and right. And all we were doing was drugs. And we were just all, that was it, party, party, party. And, you know, there was a whole lot of violence with it because it was a whole lot of domestic violence between my best friend and her husband. Well, it was really her you know, common-law husband. And it was escalating out of control. It was getting more and more violent. You know, he was beating on me because I was trying to protect her. I had already been abused my whole life. I was like, now I've got my best friend's boyfriend beating on me. I mean, this is ridiculous. Like, at the age of 21, I thought, how long am I going to live like this? Like, am I just going to, like, you know, is this just going to be my life? You know, can I change this? I just want to do something normal. I just want to be this normal person. I just want to do normal things, you know. Like, just be a woman and just be a normal working woman, you know. And this realization came to me that I could do this. I could change, you know. And so I got off the drugs at the age of 21, which was really great. I stopped doing drugs, and I really wasn't a big drinker in the first place, but drug abuse and whatnot was huge for me. So I got off the drugs and went straight. And so really my biggest vice now is cigarettes. You know, that's my biggest vice. I'm actually trying to quit. And, but yeah, that's the thing. I said, I want a different life, you know. Like, something within me was just screaming out, like, you know, I didn't go to prom. I didn't have boyfriends. I didn't want anybody touching me. I didn't like the, you know, I was just sexually shut down from being sexually abused. I couldn't even enter into any kind of relationship, really, because I couldn't allow myself to be in any kind of relationship with a guy. You know what I mean? I just didn't trust anybody. And so, yeah, it was hard. I mean, I had to kind of, you know, stop hanging around with my friends in order to get off the drugs and stop partying and whatnot. But they knew why I had to do it, because they knew I was going to end up in the gutter. You know, I was going to end up dead in a drug overdose or dead in a drug drug deal gone bad or whatever. And so, you know, a couple of my friends actually did end up dying that way. You know, one of my friends was shot down in his driveway, drug deal gone bad. And another one of my friends was killed in a domestic violence dispute by her common law husband. So, yeah, I mean, I was watching my friends be destroyed, you know, by this, and I thought, man, I'm going to end up in the same boat. You know, my brothers were destroying their lives. One of my brothers had just killed himself, the one that sexually abused me. And my other brother was on the streets, homeless here, up in Canada, freezing and losing his fingers to frostbite and doing drugs and overdosing. He was always overdosing and nearly dying and whatnot. Like, you know, his brain cells were pretty well fried by the time he finally did die. But I saw myself going that way, and I thought, man, I really have to change this if I want to have any kind of decent life, you know. Yeah, something inside of me just kept saying, you got to do this, you got to do this. So, you know, it's always been that little something inside that said, you know, we can do this, you know, that keeps me going, you know what I mean? And so,
part of your healing probably came too as you started writing your book, able to to put it down on paper and understand for yourself what, you know, what's happening, and to be able to share that with others to help them understand that they don't have to stay in that kind of a relationship.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I wanted people to see that, you know, that we can change these things. You know what I mean? And sometimes it takes a little bit longer than other times, and sometimes, you know, it's harder for some, you know, situations are harder for some people. But I think as long as you're seeking and searching out, you know, what's going to help you and what will work and how you can get some help and who can help you, you know, there is help out there for people, you know. And you have to actively search it out. It doesn't usually come to you and sit down. And what I was always envisioning was that somebody would come and take away my pain. And I kind of looked for that in my friendships. You know, I was always hoping that somebody would take away my pain, you know. And then I realized it was going to have to be me to do it. I was going to have to be the one to get the help and make sure that I get the help that I need, whatever kind it is. And so, yeah, it was a big-time realization that it was going to have to be me to do it, you know. And so when I started writing my book, I realized that that it was going to be a process, you know, to go through and actually work through a lot of this stuff, because I was still being haunted by memories and flashbacks and, you know, body memories and everything else. And, you know, even though my, you know, mentally quite stable, feeling pretty good, this stuff would still bother me. And so I started doing a lot of work, like just working through adult survivor, like workbooks and whatnot, self-help manuals, things like that, and talking to a lot of people. Like, I do talk to a lot of people who are survivors who, you know, who've been through some of the same types of things. And it is very helpful to have somebody to talk to, you know, instead of just keeping it all bottled up inside. So, yeah, writing the books was very helpful, definitely very helpful. And hopefully what I'm hoping is that, you know, for other survivors, that it will help them to realize that it's worth hanging in there. It really is, you know. It's like, don't ever give up. Not ever, you know. It's not an option. And for the public, you know.
Go ahead.
Oh,
I think for the most part, too, though, being able to talk about it with somebody else, no matter what your problem is, always gives you more insight and helps you be able to overcome it and heal from it. You know, because once you can talk about it, then I think you're getting past, you know, the hurt and the event itself. You know, because people keep that in for years and years. You know, a lot of people keep that in until, you know,
right,
from childhood to middle adulthood, maybe, you know, elderly sometimes, before they can say, you know, yeah, I was abused as a child, or I was abused as a teenager, or I was raped on a date, or I was raped by my grandfather or my uncle or, you know, whoever. You know,
yeah,
people
it becomes
need to come out and talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, because silence can become a you know, silence can be a killer. Silence can be a demon. Like, so silence can be the thing.
Silence killer, yeah.
You know, silence can be our biggest enemy.
Holding that in.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, the person doesn't have to go and tell the world, you know. Like, I'm doing this because I'm really, my main focal point is to be able to speak publicly for the rest of my life about this stuff. I really want to make a lot of noise. And I want to do it in a way that is, you know, realistic. Like, you know, this is the reality of child abuse. This is what people go through. And, you know, this is what children go through. Domestic violence, child abuse, child, you know, sexual assault, anything. Human rights abuses I'm very much interested in. And so, in stuffing. And so, I mean, this is why I went public with my stuff. Not everybody might, you know, is going to necessarily want to do that, you know. But I decided to put myself out there because I thought, how else am I going to do this? I need to put myself out there. And I also want the public to see exactly what an abused child would go through. Because not very many people would want to write down the details of being abused. But it actually freed me to do it. Like, it freed me because I want somebody to know. I thought, I don't want to go to my grave with this information. I really don't. Like, I want the world to know what my parents did to me and what my brother did to me. Because there was no justification here on this earth. I do believe there will be some in the next life. But, you know, not here. And so, for me, the justice comes in the form of truth. And truth means everything to me. And I thought, you know what? Like, I'm telling the truth, and I really don't care who it hurts. Truth is truth, and you know what I mean? My immediate family is definitely not happy that I've gone public with this stuff. You know, they don't like the fact that I've gone public at all. So it put a wedge even further in between us because we weren't close anyway, and now we're really not close. Because now it's like, they're like, well, what are you doing? Look what you're doing, you know. So I'm getting, you know, opposition there. And I'm like, I don't care. They were never there for me in the first place. You know, why would I want to stay silent for abusive people who were never there for me in the first place? Like, that is ridiculous, you know. That's just the guilt trip thing, you know. Oh, look what you're doing to the family, or look, you know what I mean? It's like, no, the guilt really belongs to them because they are the guilty people. I'm just the one
speaking
the
truth. And they're still trying to cover it up, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I don't have any problems with that.
In your bio that you were not able to have any children because of the abuse.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah,
what happened then?
Well, you know, I always kind of wanted to feel like I was a virgin, you know what I mean? Because I hadn't gone with any guys, I hadn't gone out on any dates or anything normal that a young girl would do. Hadn't gone out on any going out with guys, no, nothing like that. Just parties with my friends and guys, you know what I mean? But I had never been, like, to a prom or, you know, anything like that, or to a dance or anything like that. And hang out like a boyfriend type. So I kind of got, you know, had put it in my head that I was a virgin, right? So I went to have a checkup because I had met this guy that I just loved this guy, and he loved me, and we just really hit it off, and we wanted to be intimate, and I wanted to be on the pill, you know? And so I went for my first checkup, gynecologist checkup, and I wrote on the form that I was a virgin, you know, and had never had ever any sexual contact or intercourse. And during the exam, the lady was just looking at me, like, and after the examination, she was talking to me. She goes, you know, so you wrote on your chart that you've never ever had sexual intercourse before. And I was like, yes, that's correct. She's like, well, honey, you know, I mean, you can say you're a virgin all you want, but, you know, we know you've been sexually abused, and, you know, you've got every sign of sexual assault, you know. No, you're not a virgin, honey. You can say it all you want. You're 21 years old. You're an adult. You can do what you want. You know, if you want to persecute, go ahead. Don't, whatever, you're an adult. See, back in those days, it was not mandatory to report that stuff. Nowadays, it would have been reported. Now, I know they kept it. Like, she did say that would be kept in the records, but they didn't make a police report out of it. And my brother had already killed himself, so it would have been a little bit too late there anyway. But, it was such a drag for me, because I sat there and I told that lady, I said, no, I'm a virgin. I'm a virgin, right? And I went home.
Physically, I mean, it wasn't that you were out sleeping around. You had been sexually abused. And
yeah, that's right. In my mind, I was trying to justify it by saying, no, I'm a virgin, you know. And I went home and I cried and I cried and I cried, you know, because I you know, it was just such a heartbreaking thing. You know, I didn't want to admit that I had been sexually abused by my brother, right, or by anybody, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was hard. It was a hard situation. They told me that I probably would not be able to carry a child if I could conceive, that I probably wouldn't be able to carry it. And they said, you probably won't even conceive a child, but if you do, you won't be able to carry it. Well, I had been told that 3 years previously after a car accident that I had when I was 18, had to have a full body scan. And they noticed at that time, they told me that I probably wouldn't carry children. They said, no, your body will probably not carry children. So I had a couple of doctors tell me that. But, you know, I just wasn't all that concerned because, I mean, I was trying to get my life together anyway. But I met this this man that I'm with now. We've been together 16 years, my sweetheart and I. We've been together, 16 years this year. We were going to have a baby. This was right in the beginning of our relationship. And so I was just turning 30. And, I lost it halfway through. So I wasn't surprised, you know what I mean? I wasn't surprised at all. But, it's been sad, you know what I mean? But I wasn't really prepared. And it's not that I wouldn't have welcomed that baby into the world and been the best mother I could be, you know what I mean? I think it's a sad thing. But, you know, I look back on it now and I'm thinking, well, you know, like I don't think I would have been able to do as good a job as I would have wanted to do. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it's not that I would think it's the best thing that it didn't happen. It just happened that way, right? So I didn't have any more children, no. Yeah. Well, this is the effect that this kind of stuff can cause. And a lot of people just, you know, there's so many people out there. You hear these voices out here in the media and around North America especially, talking about the fact that child sexual abuse doesn't hurt children. Have you heard that? Well, I have. And there's been a couple of articles that have gone around where some, even doctors will say that child sexual abuse doesn't hurt children. They forget about it. Right. Okay, sure. Well, they didn't talk to me. And they obviously didn't talk to my friends because we all have something else to say. You know what I mean? So there's a real problem with the way that the society approaches child sexual abuse. They act like it's no big deal. They act like it's something that, oh, it happened, oh, well. You know, this is a violation of a child's body. This is an assault, a violation against a child's body. And, you know, I'm sorry, it should be treated this should be like high treason. You know what I mean? Like, stringing these people up, that's what I got to say. You know what I mean? Like, it's making me sick that society likes to excuse this stuff away. There is no excuse for this, and then there never will be, you know? We need to start, people need to start waking up and realizing that the issue is that 1 in 4 girls, and pretty well now they're saying 1 in 4 boys. It used to be 1 in 7 boys, 1 in 6 to 7 boys. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 to 7 boys will experience some sexual abuse under the age of 18, whether it's unwanted sexual touching, molestation, rape, you name it. Right.
And exploitation. A lot of those kids turn to alcohol and drugs to try to forget as well. So it leads to a lot of dependence on alcohol and drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then a lot of them, you know, a lot of them will perpetuate the cycle, and they will become abusers. You know what I mean? It's got to stop. You know, that's what I have to say.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's a hard situation.
Yeah, we have. A few more minutes here, Lori. Can you go ahead and just let them know the names of your books and your website here, where they can get the books?
Yeah, sure. Well, all my stuff is at lulu.com, and it's all under it's my spotlight, my little author page thing there. And if you go to Lulu, you can go www.lulu.com/spotlight/ Lori Ann Smith, LAURIE, capital LAURIE, capital ANN, and capital SMITH. That's where you can find my stuff on Lulu, and it's not really for sale. It is on Amazon as well. Like if you look for I've written three books, A Life of Death and Redemption, and Levita Juvies, which is spelled L-A-V-E-T-A, Levita Juvies, and also another book, my latest book, which was One Child Abuse Survivor to Another, The Journey. And those are at Amazon as well. And, yeah, they're available, you know, for download. You can download them. That's probably it's the cheapest way to go. The books are, yeah, the books are a little bit more expensive. But
give out a couple of other websites real quick here, too. For anyone that's been either raped, abused, or, you know, anything, I guess any kind of abuse, you can go to the RAINN website, and that's www.rainn.org, and that's the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And then also you can go to the domestic violence hotline at 1-800-799-7233. So anybody out there that needs some help, you can reach out to those two websites for any kind of help that you may need.
That's right. And I say, yeah, just reach out, you know. Yeah. Don't stay silent and on your own, you know, get some help, right? It's a good thing.
Definitely. We appreciate you coming on and sharing your story, Lori. And, you know, if you can, go ahead and get on our website and put your information up there as well.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome.
And that's at thestreetsdontloveyouback.moon.com. And we have a social network where you can put all your information and any other resources that you may have.
That's awesome.
And we'll get them up there. We do have quite a bit of resources, but I'm always looking for more to add.
That's awesome.
Well,
I appreciate that. That's wonderful. Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you so much, Lucinda and Boyd. You know, like, I have I'm just getting over a really bad cold. So hopefully people can understand me. But my voice is terrible tonight, but the cold is still hanging on. But I appreciate this so much. Thank you for doing this, for having me on here, and for all the work that you're doing out here to help people. Like, I think that is just awesome. I just wish you both all the best and keep on going. You know, like,
definitely. And like you say, if you're in some kind of a situation like that, talk to somebody, because that's the first step out. That's the first step to healing, and that's the first step to being able to change your life. You know, whether it's drugs, abuse, violence, you know, anything.
Yep, bullying or anything.
Definitely. Give them your blog talk site one more time and the times that you're on, so they can come on and listen to you there as well.
Okay, yeah, I have I do shows here on Blog Talk Radio at www.blogtalkradio.com, and then /, Lori, Laurie hyphen Smith, S-M-I-T-H, and or you can type into the Blog Talk search Lori Smith, that'll come up too. But my shows are called The Whole Issue, and I have, in the morning I do One Child Abuse Survivor to Another, and that's my healing journey. That's actually my healing journey that I go through in the morning. I don't have a show tomorrow morning, but I do on Friday morning. And just for half an hour in the morning, and it's early, early in the morning. So most people listen to that one archive. And I do a child abuse prevention show. Child Abuse Prevention is Up to Us, usually on Friday nights. And I do a worldwide epidemic of child abuse and human rights abuses on Saturdays. And so I've been skipping a lot of those shows. It's just been so busy. But I do plan on kind of getting back to that, because it's very important. And I also do a little Bible study show on Sundays, Mount Bethel Christian Bible Study. That's just me talking about what God's done in my life and the difference that, you know, that I've seen, the change in my heart, you know.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, I have hope now. I have hope and I have light and I have love in my heart. You know, the hatred has been pushed out, the rage, the anger, all of that horrible stuff that was just eating me up, just tearing me up, is gone. You know, and now, like, I'm still dealing with some of these stuff, the aftermath, but it's nothing like it was. And so I would just say, you know, people, don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. You know, when you think you can't go another step, you reach out. And you if you have to, you call a crisis line. But whatever you do, you don't ever give up. It's not an option.
Definitely. Well, we thank you, Lori, and we look forward to hearing a little bit more about what you do some other time on your shows, and you know, definitely stay connected with us, and we'll help network you as well.
That's great. Thank you so much, Lucinda. That's wonderful. I
You're
great
welcome.
Talking.
I'm glad that you've been able to come to the place where you're at now to be able to heal and share your story with others, because it is a definitely, you know, powering, strong story, and so many people have gone through the same thing and may not know, you know, how to get over it or where to reach out, and you know, we're just glad that you're out here as a voice to speak to those and let them know that there is help and there is a way out.
That's right. Yeah, that's all. You know, there's a lot of people in front of me with their hands out telling me the same thing. You know, and that's why I decided, I thought, you know what, I want to do that too, because it's so important, you know, just reach out, because sometimes people don't know you're hurting. Sometimes people don't know you're in a bad place, you know, and they don't realize it. You got to reach out. You got to be the first one, make the move, and get some help. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, we are going to go ahead and close out tonight with a song. Let's find it here. Called Guide and Protect Us, and we thank you, Lori, for coming on and continue your great work that you do, and like I said, we look forward to just continue networking with you, and just really proud of all the work that you've done.
That's awesome. Thank you, and I appreciate that. Thanks. And I love all the work that you guys are doing, too. Keep up the great work. I'll share your information, too. Absolutely.
Great. Have a great night. Thank you. A great Happy New Year this year.
You too. Thanks a lot, Lucinda. Thanks, Boyd. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
I'm
going to go out tonight with the song that Guide and Protect Us. Have a great night. Join us next week, 11:30 Eastern Time and 8:30 Pacific Time. And again, Happy New Year.
Guide and protect us, Lord. To give us your grace and your strength and your mercy. Swinging that two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice so nothing can hurt me. Even when I pass away, my legacy lives on through my seed and my working. Every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, your mercy. The first one I call every day when I wake and pray. Yeah, the one who is there when no one has a care, I say, Lord, you strengthen my soul when my mind wants to go astray. Yeah, and lift me up high when I fall and my ground gives way. Lord, how precious your love and your grace and your counting days. Lord, you show me the light and the dark, now I shall repent. Yeah, with all of my strength I will find with an iron fist. Lord, the breeders of hate and the seed today don't exist. Guide and protect us, Lord. To give us your grace and your strength and your mercy. Swinging that two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice so nothing can hurt me. Even when I pass away, my legacy lives on through my seed and my working. Every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, your mercy. With enemies close all around, I will call your name. Yeah, and slaughter the weak, you quickly with no thought or shame. Lord, for my heart is firm in your hand, so I know this pray. Lord, I'll hail up your name every day with a smiling face. Boy, I never can give in a praise to your tenderness. Lord, to be in your infinite grace is my happiness. Yeah, no matter the time or the place, you're omnipotent. Lord, you show me the light and the dark, so I shall repent. Guide and protect us, Lord. To give us your grace and your strength and your mercy. Swinging that two-edged sword. I'm fighting for justice so nothing can hurt me. Even when I pass away, my legacy lives on through my seed and my working. every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, yeah. We tried a long rocky road, Buffalo soldier, fight the power, freedom, boy. The last we step on the throne, the conquering disciples, burn your congregation, yeah. Collect your security, we build a better nation, time beside the unity. Say nothing to fight, nothing to war, but brotherly love can destroy oppression. If we come together, we can conquer all our foes, live victory eternally. But if we keep on murdering, see so much petty things, we're crumbling our destiny. But we were meant to rule upon the earth and multiply creativity and love, so I will always try to show love and respect until I die. And so I will humble and pray. Guide and protect us, Lord. Please give us your grace and your strength and your mercy. Swinging the two-edged sword, I'm fighting for justice so nothing can hurt me. Even when I pass away, my legacy lives on to my seed and my working. Every little thing I pray. Give thanks to your grace and your strength and your mercy, your mercy.